Blog Talk Radio.
We pray for blessings, we pray for peace, comfort for family, protection while we sleep. We pray for healing, for prosperity, we pray for your mighty hand to ease our suffering. Yet love is way too much to give us lesser things. 'Cause what if your blessings come through raindrops? What if your healing comes through tears? What if the seven sleepless nights are what it takes to know you're near? What if trials of this life, all your mercies in disguise? We pray for wisdom, your voice you hear, and we cry in anger when we cannot feel you near. We doubt your goodness, we doubt your love, as if every promise from your word is not enough. And all the while you hear each desperate plea, and long that we'd have faith to believe. 'Cause what if your blessings come?
And welcome back to Keeping It Real with Cindy. I'm so glad you're here.
You know how I always start the show, and first, most of you that listen on a regular basis know the song I just played is called Blessings by Laura Story. I just love that song. Anyway, I wanted to start the show with asking for some prayers, good energy, whatever you can send. I have a friend that's still in the hospital and not in the best of conditions. So we're kind of praying that he will have the angels surround him and get off the vent. But whatever is best for him, because we already know that that's how it works. Also, I want to send out prayers to anyone there out there that might need them today, or tomorrow, yesterday, whatever. But we really have a special guest today. A lot of the reason why some of you are here, we have Paul Young, the author of The Shack, which just premiered in theaters on the 3rd. And I was kind of nervous that it wasn't going to come to my little tiny island here of Key West, but it did in fact come, and so I got to see it on Thursday, and I have to say it was awesome. If you haven't seen it, it's life-altering. But a little bit about Paul. I mean, there's so much that I could say about him, but, you know, I'm just going to give you a little bit and bring him on air because that's why we have him today, to tell us about his life and his story and the movie. And he's got several books. And also I've posted his website in the chat room for anybody that wants to go over and take a look. He's got a blog. I mean, his website is really awesome. There's so much healing and really good energy over there. I just encourage you to go check it out. But, you know, he grew up in an unusual circumstance. And, well, he came from Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada, and spent a good part of his life in areas that none of us have ever touched. You know, I could go through his bio is on his website, and it's an amazing bio, but I kind of want him to tell us about it. And so with that said, I think I'm just going to bring him straight on air so that we can learn his story. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
And, you know,
can you hear?
You know, I'm like so excited to have you on, but I first need to ask you, do you want me to call you? I mean, I'll call you whatever it is. Do you go by William? Do you go by Paul?
I'm one of four generations of Williams, none of who go by William. We all go by our middle names. And
okay.
So I go by Paul. Yeah, it's the easiest. Actually, when I made the 15 copies for my kids, the very first copy said The Shack by Mackenzie Allen Phillips with William P. Young. And it was just a joke, you know, for my kids. Nobody in my world knows me as William. And it was kind of fun that eventually when the book got put into wide circulation print, the William stayed for a long time. And I would have people call me up and go like, hey, Paul, have you read this book by this William Young? Are you related to him? Because they didn't know that my first name was William. So
that's
Paul was great.
Funny.
Mr. Young is my dad. So it is funny. It's very funny.
And I put it in the chat room, but the website is actually William, but shortened to wmpaulyoung.com. So all of the listeners that are not in the chat room can kind of go there and find. And I was reading your blog. I mean, you have so much on that website that's available that the biggest reason why I'm having you on the show, as I said in my little note to you, my little email, is for the healing. I mean, there's so much that...
Well, there's a lot of healing that's needed, not just in my life, but, you know, in the community. The things that we're having to deal with, and the divisions, and just the anger and the vitriol that's out there, it just is representative of the fact that so many of us have broken hearts. And I think some of the things that The Shack talks about is an invitation into a conversation that's healing. And
right.
So I'm like thrilled to be part of it.
Yeah, and I was so nervous because I'm like, okay, he's coming on my show. And I didn't see the movie listed anywhere here because I just live on this little tiny island of Key West. It's a 2x4 island. And when I saw it, I immediately booked it, and I brought a girlfriend of mine along and my husband, which is in the background, by the way. And there was, I mean, some of the things, and there are parts of this, which we'll go over later, that might have been a little controversial, but to me, there was so much healing in that movie, and probably because I didn't come from quite as bad of a background as you, but, you know, it was still not the most pleasant, which is with a lot of people, not just us.
Yeah.
And when you, so, when yeah.
When you deal with the loss of a parent and a child, that is the greatest loss that a human being can experience. And it picks up all the other losses along the way. So I think there's a lot of people that could identify.
And of course,
yeah.
I did a lot of research about you before. Even came to ask you, I listened to interviews, I read all sorts of, you know, your website and all sorts of things. But I had to ask, I mean, I have to bring this up. When you wrote this book, the shack was actually a metaphor, right?
Yeah, and for those who don't know, I never intended this book to be actually published. It was not in my bucket list. I've written gifts for friends and family for years, and I wrote a gift for my kids. We have 6 children. Our youngest was 13 at the time, and Kim had been asking my wife. She'd been asking me for about 4 years, you know, someday as a gift for our kids, would you just write something that puts in one place how you think, because you think outside the box. And I come from a religious background. I come from modern evangelical fundamentalists, but I'm a missionary kid and a preacher's kid and the firstborn. So, you know, I just had further to go than most people. Yeah. So, so when I wrote it, it's very layered. You can read it just as a story, but you can also understand that the shack represents the heart, the broken heart that so many of us have. And it's the house on the inside, the soul of a human being, the place we get stuck. And for a lot of us, you know, we didn't get good help building the house on the inside. So it became the place we then stored our addictions and hid all of our secrets. And we never wanted anybody to actually, you know, come into that place because we were rather terrified that they would have the look of disgust on their face that we see in the mirror. And I think shame dominates a lot of us. So the movie and the book both talk about, you know, you're here because this is where you got stuck. And that's my story. So I wrote this to communicate to my own kids, like, let me tell you about the God who actually showed up and healed my heart, not the God I grew up with. And
right.
Part of that is why Papa doesn't come through the door as, you know, white bearded Gandalf with a bad attitude.
I think that was the part of the movie I liked the best, but it was also the most controversial part. And yet it touched my heart because I'm that broken person, you know, that had, well, I'm finally healed. You know, I've gotten, but I'm kind of like you in the sense of, I was raised religious, and now, you know, I'm what you might call spiritual. I believe in God, and I believe in all of that, but I don't believe I'm going to say this because I don't want to forget to say it to you, because this is what I thought when I left your movie, that you managed to convey something that I've always thought, which is that God is a love that is so strong that it would be inconceivable to the human mind.
Absolutely. I mean, it's conceivable only in part, and I think we experience it with our kids and our grandkids. I was talking to a friend of mine who's an atheist, actually, and I got in a conversation with him, and I love him dearly, and he loves me. And I said, first time we met, I said, the first thing he said to me was, you know, I'm an unbeliever. And I said, no, you're not. He said, yeah, I am. He said, you're not.
No.
He said, I am so, like I offended him, you know. And I said, no. I said, you know, belief is an activity. And a lot of people who call themselves believers struggle with doubt and their questions. So I said, you know, just tell me what you believe in. And he thought, he said, you want to know what I believe in? I said, yeah. And he thought about it for a second, and he said, I'll tell you what I believe in. I believe in the way that I love my children. And I said, so describe that to me. He said, you know what? I did not know I had the capacity to love like this until I had my own kids, but I'd step in front of a bullet for them without a question. If they got sick, I'd take that sickness if I could. And I said, so this is like other-centered, self-giving love. He said, that's exactly what it is. But he didn't know at the time that other-centered, self-giving love is the definition of the Greek word agape, which when it says God is love, it's God is agape. And so we get a taste of it in the way that we love our kids and our grandkids. But it is so much bigger than that. And even the scriptures talk about, you know, don't ever believe that you are powerful enough to push that kind of love away. You're not that strong. And it has a whole list of things that cannot separate you from that love, and it includes anything present, anything future, or any created thing, which includes me being a created thing. I don't have the power to put a stopper in that relentless affection. Now, the other part of it is that this is a love that is furious. And I don't know if you take a mom and you threaten her children, you're going to see furious love that is on. It is for them, not against them, but for them. And I think that's part of what we've missed out, because we projected our own damage on the face of God, and we painted God with the brush of our pain and our woundedness. And so we have a God that looks a lot like our parents, you know, either absent or distant or disappointed or disapproving, you know, some kind of omni-being behind Jesus. And that's what hurts us. How can you trust someone that isn't good all the time? Or how do you give yourself away to a relentless affection when you just don't know if the hammer's coming down? And a lot of our theology, sadly, is built on that. It's caused more hurt in us than almost anything.
And yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you know, as you're talking about your friend that claimed to be an atheist, my biological father, which I wasn't raised with, but I got to know as an adult, claimed all of his life to be an atheist. And as he was dying, I was at his bedside, and I'm sitting next to him, and you'd have to know me and my biological father's relationship, but it was one where I was a lot like him. I was a bit defiant, you know, which comes from my history. And although not mean, but just it was I can, because I was going against all of the things inside. And you know what I'm saying when I say that.
Sure.
It's like you are going against all of the negativity that's been thrown in your lap. And you're standing up and saying, no, I can. And it was for me, that was my one of the ways that I got through, was in my brain saying, no, I'm not that person. And, you know, when you were told that you were horrible or you were this or you were that or whatever, in an abusive sort of parental thing. And so I'm sitting at the bedside, and I whispered to my biological father. I said, I know you didn't want me here, although you know I never listened well. Well, I don't know where he got the strength, but he smiled because he loved that part of me, because it was like him. And he smiled, and he reached his little thin arms up and wrapped them around my neck and pulled me down towards him and whispered in my ear, it's time for us to go with the angels. Now, this is coming straight from a man that claimed to be an atheist all of his life.
Yeah. You know, how beautiful is that? And I find a lot of affinity with atheists, generally speaking, because I don't think that the God that they don't believe exists either. And I think some of the things and the issues that they have are absolutely legitimate. And some of my atheist friends are the most loving people that I know. And
me too.
Yeah. And you know, it's the religious people that have the most difficulty, and that's me and my people. We're the ones that create more divisions than anything, and won't deal with the questions, and won't deal authentically with our emotional world and our losses and our grief and our questions, and I have a great affinity with a lot of my friends who struggle with the issues of belief because the questions are legit, and the beautiful thing is that we don't have to defend God. You know, the religious folk of us, my people, we feel like we have to defend God, and we're kind of addicted to being right. So we create a lot of impediments that are not necessary. Yeah.
And I love that you said that. I do agree with that too. It's like the anger, you would almost use that word, the hate that goes out from some are, you know, that they're quoting. You know, I don't know how many times I've been told by religious friends that I'm going to hell because I don't sit in a pew on Sunday. And so, you know, I mean, what is that?
No, it's fear, you know, and let me tell you a little story. So I got on a flight from Ashland, North Carolina to Atlanta, which is like 23 minutes. And it's one of those two-seaters, you know, two on each side, small plane. And as I was getting on, I had this little nudge about there was a woman who was getting on, four people ahead of me. And I call them nudges. I don't know what else to call them. They're just, in retrospect, I always am going like, so I think that was a God nudge, you know, like, hey, pay attention. And I noticed her, and I thought, okay, I'm going to be sitting next to her, I'm sure. And sure enough, she stops on row four, and I'm on the window, and I say, excuse me, I'm on the window. Could you let me in? And she said, sure. And in the meantime, I pulled out, I had a copy of The Shack with me, and I carry one just to give away. And I had it in my hand, and I tried to step over her purse and her bag, and then my foot got caught in her purse. And down I went, and I ended up with the book right in her face. And I apologized, and I put it in the seat back pocket. And we get settled in, and she turns to me and says, you're not actually going to read that book, are you? And I said, well, actually, I have read it. Did you? She said, yeah, I read it about a year ago and didn't like it. I said, really? What didn't you like about it? And it was like I opened up a machine gun nest. I mean, she was after it. You know, it violates the principles of God, and I hated the, you know, representation of the Trinity and all that. She's on it, and for a little while, and then when she finally takes a breath, I go, excuse me, what was it about the Trinity that you didn't like? And she thought for a second. She said, you know, I don't quite remember, but... And then she's after it again. Well, this time it starts sounding like a little more personal. And when she takes a breath, I say, can I ask you a question? Do you know the author? And she goes, no. And then I don't know if you remember those cartoons where the little light bulb sort of flickers and flashes above someone's head. But I could almost see it. And you're not the author, are you? And I said, yeah, I am. She goes, no, you're not. I said, yeah, I am. She goes, no, you're not. I had to show her my driver's license and two credit cards and my Delta Sky Miles card. And then she's kind of stuck, like, what's she supposed to do? And I don't want her to feel bad. And she goes like, oh, this is such a God thing, which I don't really understand what that meant. But I said, look, forget this. Tell me your story. I'm really intrigued about how you ended up in a seat next to me from Asheville, North Carolina to Atlanta. And she goes, let me tell you. And she starts to unfold this unbelievably difficult story. You know, a year and a half before this, she had been kind of on a slide. She lost her family, lost her home, lost her income, and addicted, and was really in a downward spiral. And she ran into a bunch of street preachers, some fundamentalist group of people who told her about Jesus in a way that she could hear it. And because of what they had on their hearts and minds to do, they intercepted this gal in the middle of her drop. And she met Jesus, and it transformed her life. And now she's holding on to it with bare knuckles because she is so afraid that something's going to, you know, cause her to go sideways. So that's the depth of the fear that a lot of people have. I mean, Jesus yeah. saved them from this or that, and they feel that, and they just don't want to lose that. And plus, you know, sadly, a lot of times our preachers and stuff are stuck in the same kind of fear, and they preached a God who is retributive and punitive, and you've got, you know, so you end up with a relationship with hell more than you get a relationship with Jesus. And that's a sad thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we talked about it, and I said to her, you know, hey, I'm really excited for you. I've been walking in this adventure with Jesus for 40 some years, and I'm thrilled for you. Actually 50 some years. And I said, but I think I know what God would say if he was sitting right here next to you. And she said, what? And I put my hand on her shoulder and I said, relax. And she just started to cry. Tears just start rolling down her face because she is so tightly wound, you know. And we talked some more. And then when she got, you know, it's a 23-minute flight. When she got up to leave, she just said, you know, I'll read it again. And I said, I don't care if you read it again. I just think that, you know, I love your zeal. I love everything. I think you're doing great. Well, 20 minutes later in Atlanta, you know, that it's kind of a little city, just the airport.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm on the train, and the door opens up, and she walks in and sees me, and she goes, Paul! I feel like we're the longest friends, but in a way we kind of were, you know?
Yeah.
We've both
yeah.
been down similar stories. So
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people who are stuck because they're afraid, and they're stuck
right.
because they you know, I get emails where people say, I'm kind of terrified to believe that God is as good as you are saying that God is. And I say, you know, I wrote God as good as I know how. And I know that I only scrape the surface. Right?
Right.
But we've got this imagination of God that is really a difficult hurdle to get past. And then we wonder why people just don't, you know, jump into the arms of Jesus. It's because he's got a father behind him who's kind of a dark, punitive, retributive, kind of masochistic being.
Anger.
And
full of anger
yeah, well,
is what we're taught, yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
and the anger is against us.
I know.
You know, instead of, I understand anger. I'm not opposed to anger, but I think the anger of God is always for us, just like my anger is for my kids. It's not because
mm-hmm.
I don't love them. It's, in fact, because I love them. So I've got a daughter, for example, who has a micropituitary adenoma, a little brain tumor, and she's been fighting that thing for almost a decade. And I hate that.
In my prayers. In my prayers.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And so because of that little piece of tissue, she started to believe a lie about herself, that she was damaged goods. Well, I'm her dad. You know, give me the power to be a furious flame of fire. I'd crawl inside that thing and destroy it. But even more, I'd go after that lie. And it's not because she disappoints me at all. It's got absolutely nothing to do with anything. It's because I love her. And I'm opposed to anything that is opposed to her being fully human and fully alive and fully free. And I think that kind of love originates in the very heart of God. And I'm for the fury of God, but my understanding of it now is that fury is for me. George MacDonald, who is he was a guy in the late 1800s who wrote adult fantasy books. Like Fantastic. He wrote a whole lot of novels, and he was
mm-hmm.
a pastor, and he's the one that when he wrote Fantastic, which is a fairy tale, it is the book that C.S. Lewis ran into and changed C.S. Lewis's life. C.S. Lewis later said that after he read Fantastic, he never wrote another thing the rest of his life that George MacDonald was not in. And George had a massive influence on Mark Twain and all the writers of that day. And he wrote a book called Unspoken Sermons, Creation in Christ. And in that book, he says, if you trust the goodness of God, you will run to this God with your arms wide open and you will say, please, come and judge me to the core and burn out of me everything that keeps me from being fully human and fully alive. And I think in that sense, I count on that kind of judgment because I don't want stuff in me that's not good and right and beautiful and true and authentic and whole. You know, I want the stuff that's not right and not real to be burned away. And,
right.
And but I trust the love that is that furious fire. And I think
and
that's
that
what we're
would come
itself.
From love. Yeah, that burning
it,
would come from the love, not from a hate as, you know, it's almost like a fearful hate that is.
Yeah.
I had a pastor tell me, I'm not embarrassed to say so, I'm 60 now, guys, and I had a child when I was young, and you know, when I was 18, and I was raised in religion just like you, and I went to a pastor of a church and asked for my child because of my grandparents mostly to be baptized, christened, whatever, and he said that the child could never be baptized because it would carry my sin for the rest of its life.
I'm so sorry.
And I looked at him, though, and I was 18, and I looked at this guy, this pastor, and I said, so what you're telling me is that this child is not a child of God, that I should have aborted it. And he pointed to the door and told me to leave. And
yeah,
the child was,
you know, because your 18-year-old self was able to penetrate through his intellectual disassociative mind, you know, where he's stuck. And I recognize that because I've been there, and speak something to him. It's very similar. I ran into a couple guys at a seminary, and they wanted to talk to me about universalism and inerrancy, which are two topics that my people are always bringing up. And at one point I said to him, you know, but a lot of things changed for me when I became a father. You know, my view of God was impacted by my relationship with my kids. Maybe when you have kids, it'll have an impact on that. And one of the guys looks at me, he says, I have two sons. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I said, well, let me ask you a question then. Inside your theology, because I knew where they were coming from, because that's my history, I said, what if God has elected, chosen your two sons to be an expression of his justice, and that they're going to be forever in hell's torment? How are you going to feel about that? And he looks at me, and he says, not only would I be excited about it, I mean, ecstatic about it, I would have to be. And I'm thinking, like, oh my goodness, your theology has so disassociated you from your humanity that you can even imagine that. And that's the sadness of a lot of, you know, my religious family and my religious community. We're stuck inside of a very destructive imagination of God, but it's so terrifying. It's kind of like, you know, you're around an abuser and you can't get away because you don't know how to live apart from the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think religion has that tendency to do it. And you know enough about me to know that I love the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit and the Trinity and all that. I just struggle some with the indoctrination. And I understand people scrambling for some sense of certainty and worth and value, and they wrap it inside religious language, and they end up with a God that is really an abusive deity, and more like Zeus than Jesus.
Right.
And I think I think the beauty of Jesus is that Jesus comes to show us who God is. And if you want to know what the character and nature of God is, watch Jesus play with the children and touch the leper when nobody else will, and talk to the woman who nobody else will talk to. And confront the religious ideology of the day, but does so in such a way that those same guys that are stuck in their religion will come find him in the middle of the night to talk to him, because they know he's safe. They know he's saying something that stirred their heart. And when an 18-year-old little girl says something about your humanity and it penetrates through your theology and into your heart, what are you going to do? You're going to tell her to get out, you know?
Yeah, and I was okay with that, actually. Because I never believed that even then. I always felt like the fear-based part was not true. And so, but that was my defiant side, too, keeping in mind, you know, that my history caused me to fight for myself, in a sense, and I was going to even fight harder for that child that I had there. And so, you know, I could not for one second believe that my child was bound to hell for all of her eternity because of my sin. I didn't believe that. I thought, no.
Yeah.
I think, and I had to ask him, and here's the funny part, is most, you know, I grew up in an age, you know, you were there too with the, well, you were not there because you were, we were going to go into that too. But, you know, I grew up during the hippie days and all of that, where it was flower power and peace and love and all of that sort of thing. And so, you know, my whole issue with believing was I never believed, never once did I believe that the God that they portrayed as being this scary guy was. And I've had to suffer through that too, because I have an extremely religious family, and you know, they have all of this that they believe, and that's why I've been told I was going to go to hell because I didn't go to church. And I'm like, so, and you'll get a kick out of this too. I even said at one point to them, as they told me, you're going to go to hell because you don't go to church. And I said, so, because I don't sit in a pew on Sunday with a cocktail in my car waiting for me when I'm done, although I can go to the bathroom and pray, I can sit on the toilet and pray, I can walk through my house and pray, I can pray 15 times a day and talk to God 15 times a day from my home, but because you're sitting in a pew with a cocktail waiting in your car when you're done, you're not going to hell. I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you know. Well,
yeah, I do know. And you tend to scramble when you're looking for some way to win the approval and the affection of God. So you set up a whole bunch of rules to do it. And then you judge people who aren't as good at it as you are. And if that's the way it is, you know, those of us who come from really broken histories, we really have no hope. You know, if it's a matter of self-discipline and working your way into God's affection and approval, you know, all you got is cover-up. Because, again, sometimes our theology has started with the assumption that we were worthless to begin with. So it's just, you know, the mercy of God that we have anything that good happen, you know, that happens in our lives. Yeah, such a trap. And
yeah,
it's so
such
not
a
true.
It's not. And I have never felt that way. As I said, and you were completely right, but I've always felt like the love would be so inconceivable other than, as you said, with understanding the love that we have for our children, the love that we have for our grandchildren, the love that we just hold in our heart. It's kind of why I do this show, because I love also the listeners of the show, and I tell them that every week. And, you know, I'm like, they are... I try to see the patterns in the issues that are going on for the week, and I try to pull in guests that will help them with that. And so as we're talking like this, a lot of these guys might not know your history. So would it be okay for you to go over your history a little bit? Okay.
Sure. So I'm born in Grand Prairie, Alberta, 10 months old. My parents, my dad, who is not, I mean, he just didn't have a chip for being a dad. He had been orphaned at 12. My grandfather was not a loving man. And and just a lot of dysfunction and stuff. But, you know, when you're a child, you don't know what your parents have been through. Everything that's wrong, you blame yourself anyway. And so the three of us moved to the highlands of New Guinea. My dad was a pioneer missionary, and he grew up as a hunter-trapper and a logger. So, you know, he was built for that kind of stuff. And I'm the firstborn son, and he didn't know what to do with all of his anger. You know, this is back when people didn't even know they had baggage, and if they'd have known, they wouldn't have known what to do with it. And he dumped it on me. So one of my great sadnesses as a child was being terrified of my dad, who was an abusive disciplinarian. And then in the tribal culture that I grew up in, sexual abuse started before I was five, and at six I'm sent away to boarding school, and sexual abuse happened in boarding school, and this was a missionary Christian boarding school. But again, this was back in the day when there were a lot of things that were dangerous, and plus I got dislocated from my sense of family and tribe and color and everything else, and I didn't, you know, what do you do to survive? You become a performer. And I did. I'm in an unfortunate sort of way, depending on how you look at it. I'm actually pretty smart and creative. I didn't actually know that until my mid to late 20s, but I just thought I fooled people. But that's what shame will tell you. And being smart and creative empowered my ability to hide, which prolonged, I think, the journey of having to deal with my stuff. And I drug all this into my marriage, but thankfully I married a woman who is a very powerful human being, coming from a family that has got a lot of substance to it. A Minnesota, North Dakota gal, born in North Dakota, you know, where there's no 50 shades of anything. You know, it's all this or that.
Yeah, and I have a girlfriend there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, Kim saved my life. She paid a high price for it. My world blew up when I'm 38, and Matthew, who was our sixth, had been born. And that started an 11-year deconstruction, reconstruction process. Part of it included therapy, trying to work out all this pinness. And it was in that 11 years is represented by Mackenzie's weekend in the shack, where you have to deal with the goodness of God question. You have to deal with your inability to trust, which has been my whole journey. Mm-hmm. And there's something about sexual abuse that not only just obliterates your boundaries, but it puts you in a position where trust is something that is so, you know, give me religion. Just tell me what to do. Just don't ask me to trust God or trust anybody else. And that needs to be healed. And it took me a lot of years. It took me 50 years to wipe the face of my father off the face of God. It took me 50 years to finally become a child for the first time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But the big reconstruction stuff is done. You know, I've got a lot of finish work to do, but I'm telling you, the big pieces, they've really been addressed, and there's a coherence to my life. I have such a greater capacity to love and to be present, and you know, I'm a way better grandfather than I was a father, and
mm-hmm.
and my kids all know that. But I was a better
right.
father than my dad was, and I know his life really well, and I know that he took a big step away from his history just to even give me a running start at mine, and
right.
yet he was such a part of what was broken. And that took just a long time to deal with. So, you know, in the whole process, you know, Jesus became the one that came to save me from God the Father, as well as my father. And it's all messed up, you know. And
it is, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
But at the
go
same
ahead.
Time,
I was just going to ask you if because of and sorry, if I mean I kind of feel. As though because of the brokenness, and I was also sexually abused by my stepfather from the age of four, and because of the brokenness,
I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right. I've healed also.
It's not all right. I know.
It's not all right.
But nothing
no, it's
justifies.
Not.
But no, it's not.
You know what I'm saying here? It's like I'm healed
know,
from that.
I do know it. Yeah.
And so it's like there's, in the word that I think you might have been trying to come up with earlier, is this intuitiveness that we learn as children so that we can pick up on things that maybe children that haven't been through this don't pick up on, and we can try to normalize our life by intuitively knowing when we need to do certain things to keep our parents from behaving.
Alive.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the intuitiveness that you're talking about, I think, goes on past even when it's done. You know, mine stopped at 9 because my stepfather crushed his legs and he could no longer get me. But it was an intuitiveness that I had. And as I stepped through life, there were things that were thrown my way that some people might see as problematic. You know, I cared for my grandparents for over 20 years and things like that. As I went through those things, I was taught things that helped me to understand why these things in the past happened, that helped me to forgive through that
right.
understanding. And I just kind of wanted to bring that up a little bit since we've only got, like, what, 13 minutes? But I'm like, those,
yeah.
you know, to get the listening audience to understand that there are gifts that are given to us even though we went through these struggles. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I do. It doesn't justify anything, and I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, nothing justifies sexual abuse. I don't care what you get out of it. You know, it's wrong. And
right.
But I agree with you that there are ways that you can put 10 children in front of the same abuse and you'll have 10 lives go 10 totally different directions. And part of it is the uniqueness of the human creation, who you are. But the skill set that you develop, which eventually you have to let go of because they become impediments to relationships, like hypervigilance. You know, like just knowing when you're in danger, or you know, you're aware of everything that's happening because you know where the doors are, you know where the windows are, you know, you just know, and that intuitiveness saves your life, but it becomes an impediment because you start,
right.
you know, because shame just messes you up, and you lose the ability, for example, to distinguish between a value statement and an observation. So with the survival mechanisms and skills comes a whole bunch of other stuff that is just not helpful, and that's a part of shame, and it has to be dealt with. You know, I wish it was a quick fix. I wish you could get a blue or a red pill that would just, you know, heal your soul. But because we're so incredibly crafted, it takes a God who made us and knows exactly how we were broken to climb into this with us. And then co-create with our participation something that is actually whole. But that
mm-hmm.
takes time, and it takes community, and it takes the risk of trust. And it's hard
yes.
work. So
yes,
good on you. You know,
yeah.
good for
and,
you.
And I do agree with you so wholeheartedly here, because I didn't heal overnight. I mean, it was kind of like, as I'm caring for my grandparents, I'm learning these things, and then suddenly I found myself understanding that my stepfather, for instance, that molested and abused me from a young age, it, you know, I always felt unloved, and you know how that goes. And
absolutely.
And I figured it out that it had never really had much to do with me. It had more to do
it
with
didn't.
Them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But as a child, you can't.
No.
Process that, you know,
mm-mm.
and you just, I mean, and biologically, in terms of your neurology, you don't have the capacity to do that. And so everything that is wrong, and we know that this now, because of neuroscience, and the massive work that's been done, we know that children in the womb are affected with what's going on around them. And so, you know, there's stuff that gets wound up wrong from the very beginning that takes a long time to work out, but it can work out. You know, I grew up in your kind of theology where basically you had to wait till you died for anything to actually get fixed. And so
mm-hmm.
death becomes your salvation. Well, that's not true. Not true. But the work that's required and the fact that you just got to stop pointing fingers. I had to come to a place where I stopped pointing fingers at the abuse because it was sort of becoming a sanctuary I could hide inside. I could blame something and then justify, well, you know, my choices as if
right.
that was legitimate, and it's not. But owning it, that's a whole different thing. And
it was really hard. It was really hard.
Oh, it's so hard. It's so hard. It's hard work.
Yeah,
but
and my people in it is. My people in the chat room are like, we could listen to him forever, and I'm like, I know. And so once again, because we're coming close to the end, I have to tell you, he has some amazing, amazing stuff on his website, including a place where we can all post about love, you know, how we're healing or people can help, you know, we can help each other with that in his blogs. And it's William Paul Young, that's W-M Paul, P-A-U-L, Young, YOUNG.com. And I really am going to kind of push you guys towards going there, but he also has Facebook walls. So just put Paul Young in and he'll come up. And you know, W.M. Paul Young. But I'm sorry, I just had to get that in there again so that
thank you. I
the listeners
that.
Would know where to find you. And if you get a chance, you absolutely need to go see this movie because it will change everything you thought.
Yeah. Take tissues. I'm just telling you. You know, and because it hits you. It's an encounter is what it is, which is like the book. And people ask me and they say, you know, because they were kind of afraid, you know, and I'm going like, no, if you love the book, you're not going to be disappointed by the movie. They put their hearts and souls into this thing in order to try to keep it at a level of impact that the book had, because the book had already done it in their own lives. Gil and Lonnie Netter, Gil's the producer, and he did Life of Pi and Marley and Me and Blindside. And I mean, they already were way involved with The Shack before he even was slated to become the producer. Stuart Hazeldine is the director, has a deep faith and loves the book. Octavia Spencer, who plays Papa, comes from a Baptist background, you know, in the South. And the book had already had an impact in her. So, you know, Sam Worthington, he's a Mackenzie, and he's talked about it recently in interviews and stuff. And he said, you know what, if you want to know my faith journey, it's Mackenzie. When he came on to the first day set, he had a 10-week-old baby, their first baby. And so here he is playing a man who's lost one of his own children. And he has a child. And so he's saying, you know, it's not really acting. He's saying, those are my questions. The questions that Mackenzie's asking are my questions. And I think that's partly why the book and the movie has had such an impact across the globe, is it's human. It's respectful to our humanity and the losses that we've experienced. And it says, you know what? Your tears actually matter. It matters to God. It matters to us as a human family. And there is a way, but you can't do this alone. This requires community, not just with God, but God with skin on. And part of it is just beginning to take the risk of letting somebody into that space with you so that you can come out from your secrets and your hurts and your loneliness and everything else. And that's part of why we're here in each other's lives, is to do that. So, and thank you for what you're doing. Our folks that you provided a community for, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
and
I love doing this, and I love doing it because there's, just like me, you know, when I was reaching out, I don't know that I could use the words reaching out. I didn't feel safe reaching out, just like you didn't feel safe, so we bottled it. And I wanted people to know that I'd been there in most all of the instances, not all, but a lot of them, where they're struggling, and that there was a way out. And that's why I started the show. I was horribly shy, and that also came from my history. And
yeah.
So it was the first time I came on air, I thought I was going to throw up. And that was like 8 years ago. I was shaking, literally shaking. And yet I knew I needed to do it. And so I'm still going. It's like there are people out there that need help, and they need real help, not this phony listening to somebody kind of help. I open up my Facebook page for my radio show for anybody to private message me, you know, if they're struggling. And that's because we need to be there for each other, as you just said. We need to be there.
And sometimes the greatest gift is not that a person says anything, but you know that they are there. And mm-hmm. that presence is enough. You know, because sometimes some of these things they don't have answers to. Some things are just wrong. And it's okay to know that they're wrong and to say that they're wrong. And then okay, they're wrong. Now let's find a way forward. Let's put one foot in front of the other. Let's stay inside the grace of just one day. Let's stop our secrets, you know? Because we all have a drive toward authenticity in our humanity, and I think God meets us right in that space and joins with us to empower us to make choices and do the work, do the hard work. Yeah.
And you have no idea how much I appreciate you coming on. I have to tell you, when I sent you that email, I was like, oh, he's, you know, all that can happen is he won't answer me or he'll say no. And so, you know, I was so excited when you came back and said, sure, let's set it up. And so I have to give you that. And I think I even wrote in that email, I have a tiny little show. It's an internet radio show. But to me, these people are as important as anyone else, you know.
Absolutely.
And I just,
this, you know, you're the one, I'm the one that Jesus left the 99 to go find. This is about the one. This is not about the masses. You know, people look and they go like, well, you got a book that's done all this stuff and now a movie and all that stuff. And I'm going like, no, this is about the one. I made 15 copies that did everything I ever wanted this book to do. So this is about the one. And it doesn't matter to me if it's a small internet radio show or if it's a massive thing. The one is still the one. And so I am so honored that you would invite me, and honored at the invitation, and that I got to spend this holy ground time with you and the folks that are part of your community. I think that's a marvelous gift to me.
I am like
so
honored
you.
That you accepted. And if sometime in the future, I might email you again, because everybody wants you back.
Which would be fine.
To cover some other bases. Not only that, but he has more books out there than just The Shack. And so, I mean, I would love to get into, I mean, you can't cover very much in an hour, you know, so I would love to get into some of those other books. And there's one in particular, and you already know which one it is, and I'm sure. It's the one about the lies, and I'm pulling
lies,
it up now.
Lies we believe about God. Lies we believe about God.
That one.
That just came out last week, so yeah.
Yeah.
That has a lot of conversation capability around it, you bet.
I know. Anyway, thank you so much, Paul, for coming on. And I hope
and
to keep
you
in touch. And so, yeah, thanks, and we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
You bet. You bet. Blessings on your day and to everyone out there.
You too. Night.
Bye-bye.
And so, bye-bye. And so, guys, I'm like, I know it went by really, really fast, and I wanted to ask so many more questions, but, you know, an hour only gives us so much time. And so I hope you enjoyed that. There's so much more that he has if you go over to his website and take a look. But I hope you enjoyed just this little bit. You know I appreciate you. Without you, I wouldn't have a radio show. And I know I say this every single time, but I truly mean it. I love you guys. I mean, bottom line, without you, there would be no show. And I do this because of you. Anyway, I'm going to, let's take a look. I think I'm going to play a song to end the show because I put it up for an hour and a half like I always do. And so let me look through my list and decide which one I want to play. You know what? I always play Key West musicians. I think today, because of this show, I'm going to play more. I'm going to play 100,000 Angels by Bliss. And so here we go. Thanks again, guys. Love you.
Do you?